Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In a time when West Virginia is losing population, we found people who are actually coming to the state to grow lavender.
Came up here as the veteran program to learn how to grow lavender. Everybody loves it. We moved up here to turn a new chapter in our lives.
Lavender farming on coal mine-stripped mountaintops. It's part of a new initiative called Green Mining. And researchers hope to turn coal mining pollution into valuable elements used in things like smartphones.
The acid mine drainage production in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Eastern Ohio can supply anywhere between 800 tons per year to maybe 2,200 tons per year.
And we'll hear about a man who is using coal to help fly airplanes and even space rockets.
The foam that we make from coal has been covered with basically a plastic covering. So this will end up making a part to go in some kind of airplane.
These innovations and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It isn't news that Appalachia is struggling economically. If you followed the boom and bust cycle of the coal industry, you know that we've been here before. Coal production in Appalachia fell by almost half between 2005 and 2015. A lot of people lost their jobs. In the past year, the coal industry has rebounded a little, but most economists agree coal alone is not the answer to our financial problems. Some people see these challenges as opportunities. They're asking, what does Appalachia have to offer besides coal? And they're coming up with some pretty innovative answers. That's what today's show is all about. Appalachian innovators. As the steel and coal industries fade, small towns in Appalachia are struggling to survive. And sometimes it seems like that struggle is the only thing people in other parts of the country know about Appalachia. But for the past 20 years, entrepreneurs have quietly been working on a different strategy, one that leverages what's left of the region's natural beauty and resources to grow Appalachia's economy. As part of our Appalachian Innovators series, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports on the steady climb of the tourism industry in parts of Appalachia.
About 10 years ago, after a long career in computer sales, Rod Darby was downsized and out of work.
And I got angry about that, so I thought I'm never going to work for somebody else again, so I'm going to go start my own business.
As he researched what that business would be, he started noticing a lot of activity around the Great Allegheny Passage, a 150-mile bike trail along an old rail line connecting Pittsburgh to Cumberland, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. Construction was still in progress then, but it's since been completed. Darby wrote up a business plan to open a bar and restaurant along the trail in West Newton, a small town about 30 miles south of Pittsburgh. He shopped the idea around.
I went to a large bank. They said, nope, that's not what we do. Went to a medium-sized bank. Hey, great plan. That's not what we do. Went to a small bank. Great plan. We're not sure about this trail.
Then he went to a community development program called the Progress Fund.
And they said, this is exactly what we do. And they've been a fantastic partner for me since we started.
David Cayley, co-founder of the Progress Fund, saw a need to support tourism in the region 20 years ago.
So we started basically a nonprofit bank and started making loans to small businesses.
They initially invested in nearby Ohiopyle, financing a whitewater rafting facility, a bed and breakfast, and other tourism projects. Today it's bustling with cyclists, hikers, and rafters spending money to eat, shop, and stay overnight. Cayley wanted to try something similar in West Newton, which is only a 34-mile bike ride from Pittsburgh. Then Rod Darby walked in the door.
Rod became one of the first people outside of Ohiopyle to start investing in the other little towns. So when he approached and said, I want to do something here, we were jumping for joy.
Today, Darby's Trailside Restaurant serves pub food, boasts a full bar and a takeout beer shop.
Any particular flavor, Dave?
28 people work here, 16 of them full-time. And Darby says business is hopping.
People ask me all the time, does that trail help you out? And I said, the trail's the reason I'm here.
The Progress Fund's David Cayley walks just a few feet from the restaurant onto that bike trail that runs along the river.
We have all these nifty signs so you don't get lost.
The fund invested in pizza and fast food restaurants here, a canoe and kayak livery, and the renovation of a bed and breakfast, totaling nearly $2.5 million.
Well, we have 9 loans that we've done in West Newton. And it's really that kind of level of investment's changing West Newton's future around tourism. Why nine loans here? Well, that Great Allegheny Passage is a huge economic opportunity.
Based on studies and surveys over 17 years, the Progress Fund estimates nearly 1 million people use the Gap Trail annually, creating an economic benefit of $50 million along the route. 65 trail-related businesses have opened in the past decade. As the steel and coal industries have declined, Kaley says West Newton and other towns in the region have faced years of disinvestment. But he says the Progress Fund is trying to help them see what they do have to offer.
The resource here is the landscape and all the recreational opportunities. So it is a fully invested economic development program, but it's one that relies on the environmental aspects or environmental qualities of the community rather than being the extractive industry.
Kent Spellman is encouraged by the results of the Progress Fund. He's pushing for this kind of development along West Virginia's abandoned train tracks, too.
I'm a consultant with the Rails to Trails Conservancy out of Washington, D.C.
Spellman has spent most of his life in West Virginia. He says some communities are suffering from something like post-traumatic stress disorder because of the loss of industry in recent decades.
Their future, too often, in southern West Virginia, but also in many northern West Virginia communities, has been determined by that big extractive industry, or that big steel mill, or that big chemical company. Those things are going away, and it's, I think, a time for us in rural Appalachia to start understanding that we have to take responsibility for our future ourselves.
Spellman is currently focused on completing a 230-mile rail trail from Parkersburg to Morgantown, hooking up with the Great Allegheny Passage into Pittsburgh. He sees rail trails as the new Main Street, the place where people walk their dogs and talk with neighbors, and a piece of the region's future economy. Christine Risch isn't quite convinced.
Well, it may never replace to the level what was lost by the coal industry.
Risch is director of resource and energy economics at Marshall University Center for Business Economics in Huntington.
Because those jobs were extremely good paying jobs. Tourism industry does not pay as good of wages. You know, they're lower wage, closer to minimum wage.
But Risch also sees reason for hope in the tourism industry. She points to the Hatfield-McCoy Trail system in southwestern West Virginia, an area she says has lost more coal jobs than most of the state. While Rails to Trails are for bicycles, the Hatfield-McCoy Trails are for motorized all-terrain vehicles. Her center surveyed visitors there in 2014.
We estimated, based on surveys, that about $22 million was staying in the area for what people were spending to buy permits to ride the trails, for lodging and food and fuel that they needed while they're in the area.
According to the Marshall study, the Hatfield-McCoy Trail system was supporting nearly 240 jobs in 2014. Risch says the number of permits sold has continued to grow since then, as has the need for lodging and other amenities to support those visitors.
It's not replacing the coal industry yet, but it certainly has potential to grow quite a lot.
Ken Spellman says trail tourism could bring a longer-term economic boost to the region because it can showcase the beauty and livability of West Virginia.
And if we get just a small percentage of the people who come through our communities to be thinking down the road about maybe that would be a good place to rear a family, maybe that would be a good place to bring my small business, that is the goal of tourism.
Mary Popovich agrees. She's the mayor of West Newton, Pennsylvania, and today she sits at a beautifully renovated downtown building looking out onto the Youghiogheny River. She says thanks to the trail and the economic development around it, there's excitement in her old coal town. Even the elementary school that almost closed is now seeing increased enrollment.
There's a lot of houses that are getting sold to young families. This is how you help your community grow in numbers, and then you're going to get more businesses.
The Progress Fund has invested a lot in West Newton, hoping other former coal towns will look here and start reimagining their futures as trail towns. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Julie Grant.
Not all creeks and rivers in Appalachia are pretty or even safe. Here in Appalachian coal country, there are thousands of miles of streams that run bright orange with acid mine drainage. But one industry's waste is another industry's riches. Glynis Board has this story about how researchers are aiming to turn coal waste into valuable, high-tech products.
Paul Zimkevich is standing in front of a silo full of crushed limestone that slowly gets flushed into a stream pouring out of an old coal mine here. It's a state-of-the-art, state-operated facility that treats acid mine drainage. If it weren't here, the stream would run rusty red, killing ecosystems in its path.
Okay, so we're at the Omega Mine, and the Omega Mine is about 4.5 miles south of Morgantown, West Virginia. And it's an area that's been heavily mined for coal since the Civil War.
This year, Zimkevich, the director of the West Virginia Water Research Institute at West Virginia University, was awarded $2.6 million federal dollars plus funds from the private sector. His research aims to locate, isolate, and commercialize select hard-to-gather elements of the periodic table, elements that are critical to the technology age we live in. Some of those elements can be found in acid mine drainage.
I finished up some calculations that the acid mine drainage production in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Eastern Ohio can supply anywhere between, and this is in terms of rare earth, somewhere between 800 tons per year to maybe 2,200 tons per year. 800 tons a year is basically what the military needs for defense purposes and contractors.
Zimkevich and a handful of other scientists in and around the Ohio Valley make up the majority of the American team dedicated to cracking the rare earth element puzzle. That is, the team that's on the hunt for rare earth elements and how to build an industry around them. The Americans are the underdogs. Right now, China is the team to beat, where 95% of the rare earths used in phones, electric cars, and smart bombs are all sourced.
In 2011, the prices of rare earth elements spiked, in part because of a supply problem from China. And so that instilled an interest in researching rare earth, other sources of rare earth elements throughout the world, but also in the United States.
Tom Tarka is the technical project lead for rare earth elements at the National Energy and Technology Laboratory in West Virginia, or NETL. He explains about 140,000 tons of rare earth elements are produced globally each year into products on the market. There's no commercially available alternative for sourcing rare earths outside of China. And since the U.S. doesn't want to have to rely on any single other nation to provide important components critical to national security, government funds are funneling into research at NETL in Morgantown, a national lab that focuses largely on coal and fossil fuel research. Mary Ann Alvin is the head of the Rare Earths Division there.
Right now what we have is actively 15 programs, 15 projects that are investigating not only separations, investigating where we can find our best reserves, and how can we take this forward.
Rare earth mines have tried and failed in the U.S. already. They just weren't profitable on their own. The hope now is that rare earth mining can be economically viable if it piggybacks on other mining operations, like coal. Tom Tarka from NETL explains that researchers have already begun to identify rare earth elements in and around coal seams, as well as those within waste products associated with mining and burning coal.
In Appalachian coals, especially Southern West Virginia and Central App, we're seeing more heavy rare earth elements. And that's good because these heavy rare earth elements, they're rarer and they have an increased value as a result.
The thing is, rare earths are not rare so much as rarely concentrated and hard to extract. It usually takes acids and harsh chemical processes, which create the stuff of environmental nightmares. But as Paul Zimkevich at the Water Research Institute knows well, West Virginia is already coping with environmental nightmares.
Before the Clean Water Act, the Monongahela River at Morgantown was orange, and it had a pH of about 4.2. It was absolutely dead. There was hardly anything alive in it. The only difference between then and now is the amount of treatment that water gets before it winds up in the river. In the Mon River Basin, I think something like a third of all the acid mine drainage is actually being treated in industrial-sized operations.
So acids are literally seeping from coal mines everywhere throughout Appalachia and apparently leaching rare earth elements in the process.
It turns out that the more acid seams give us the best results because it has the most pyrite. Pyrite in turn generates the acid that leaches the rare earths out of the rock.
Zimkevich's research is not only identifying which elements exist in acid mine drainage, or AMD, and the sludge left from treatment of polluted water, but also how to process the elements and get them into a marketable form.
Rather than sludge disposal being a liability, if you could actually make some money on it, and it's probably not going to pay for all of the costs of AMD treatment, but even if it knocks down the cost by 20, 30, 40%, that's a very, very significant incentive to continue treating acid mine drainage.
And Zimkevich is just one researcher. Others in Kentucky and Pennsylvania are studying lots of other coal waste products like coal ash. There are literally mountains of discarded coal ash throughout the region. Coal scientists estimate that with continued research and the right economic pressure, a rare earth industry in the Ohio Valley could exist in 10 to 20 years.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board.
In a minute, we'll hear more about how innovators are creating jobs by transforming the remnants of coal mines. I'm Jessica Lilly, and you're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Many Appalachian mountains have been blasted, stripped, and hollowed for their valuable riches. What's left behind is usually a barren landscape that doesn't seem good for much, but imagine if they could be covered with fields of purple. Roxy Todd met up with some farmers in West Virginia who hope lavender could give the state's struggling economy a boost.
I'm standing on land in Boone County that looks like a moonscape, with parched gray dirt and jagged blasted-off mountaintops in the distance. Donnie Facemeyer is a laid-off coal miner. He helped strip this mountain back when he was working for Pritchard Mining.
A year ago, I'd have laughed at you if you'd have told me they were going to farm on a strip job, because it's all just shot rock. But these plants seem to be doing real good in it.
These lavender plants are little more than scrawny bushes now, barely a foot tall. But Facemeyer is hoping this mountaintop will soon be turned into fields of purple. He's one of the farmers taking part in a new project launched by the West Virginia Regional Technology Park in Kanawha County to grow lavender on former strip mines. Turns out, the plants actually thrive in the dry, rocky soil that surface mining leaves behind. This job is what's keeping Facemeyer and his family from leaving the state.
Me and my wife were going to until I ran into this job. We were going south. Going to sell everything we own and take off. Start all over.
Like Facemeyer, other new farmers are hoping the lavender industry can provide a steady source of income to support them in West Virginia. It's a new industry here in Appalachia, but the idea was enticing to a handful of people who signed up for a training class, even some who moved to West Virginia for the program. Some came from Texas, others from Ohio. One family came from Florida. Sky Ritchie and his wife, Deborah, say a fellow veteran told them about the Lavender Project, and so they sold everything they owned and moved to the Mountain State.
Came up here, there's the veteran program to learn how to grow lavender. Everybody loves it. We moved up here to turn a new chapter in our lives.
As part of the program, the Ritchies get paid an education stipend of $10 an hour for the 6 weeks they spend learning about lavender and how to grow it. The program is called Green Mining, and it's just getting started. Last year, it received a $1 million grant from the Appalachian Regional Commission's Power Initiative, which helped pay for salaries and student stipends. But can it work? We reached out to more than a dozen lavender farmers across the United States, and each told a similar story. It's a lot of fun and a great way to earn a small side income. But only two farmers, both in Washington State, said they make a full-time living from lavender alone. Shelly Keeney has a small lavender farm in her backyard in Huntington, West Virginia. It's a peaceful place. The scent of lavender wafts through the air.
I have about 100 lavender plants, a little over that. And I do pretty well with it. But as far as having a full-time business, I would probably have to have, let's say, 10 acres at least to just solely do lavender.
The plants Keeney has keep her busy enough, especially since she also has a full-time job. Inside her garage, she has a small workshop. Fresh lavender hangs from the wooden beams to dry. Keeney shows me the jams and jellies she sells at farmers markets.
This one is a strawberry jam with just a hint of lavender. You don't want to overpower anything that you use lavender in that you're going to eat for culinary purposes. And this is great on scones and biscuits.
She says she gets requests from farmers markets across West Virginia, way more than she has time for. One product that's in especially high demand is essential oil.
can. Maybe it's our busy lives and we all need to calm down a little bit. So people are looking for ways to help them calm down, and lavender's going to do it.
The coordinators for the Green Mining Lavender Project want to tap into the essential oil aromatherapy industry too, but they'll need to produce at least 2,000 gallons of oil to sell to the larger companies. At the Green Mining headquarters in South Charleston, a former Dow Chemical coal testing lab has been transformed into a distillation station for lavender. Project coordinator Marina Sawyer says Green Mining is prepared to meet demand. They want Appalachia to be the new home for USA-sourced lavender oil.
Unless you buy locally grown or something that was made out of Washington, then it's probably from overseas, because that's where most of the lavender comes from. It hasn't been that big a crop in the U.S. before.
Lavender could bring in some revenue to southern West Virginia, but it's unlikely to bring back the thousands of coal jobs that have disappeared in the past decade. West Virginia's chief economist, John Deskins, says that although coal production has bounced back some,
still far down from where it was a few years ago. So ultimately in the state, we desperately need to diversify our economic mix.
He says what the state's economy desperately needs now is more innovators, people who will try out new business ideas.
Because nobody knows for sure, right? People like me study the economy, other government officials study the economy. We try to figure out what might have potential, what might not have potential, but ultimately it's up to an entrepreneur to experiment, and they'll find what works and what doesn't work.
Back up at the Boone County Strip Mine, the students in the program are busy planting baby lavender plants. One man is drilling holes with an electric rototiller. Retired Army officer James Ross is helping troubleshoot a problem the crew had yesterday. They accidentally planted in the wrong area. Now they have to go back and replant the crop. Ross is one of the program instructors. In the Army, he led missions for a battalion of 11,000 people. Now he's channeling that energy into teaching West Virginians to farm.
Now, have we got 100% solution right now on helping the state's economic problems? No, I'm not saying that. But it's the right step forward. It's the right step forward to taking this unusable land and using it for something good.
Not everyone has stuck with the program. Last summer, 16 people signed up for the class, but only half completed it. The second course had 20 graduates. Many of the trainees say they'll grow lavender on a strip mine, especially if they're able to lease the land for cheap. The coordinators with the Green Mining Program say they're applying for another federal grant to help them transition to a co-op model. If they succeed, the lavender farmers would be the owners of the entire business and operation within 3 years. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Boone County.
To see a video of our short story about lavender farming, head over to our website at wvpublic.org. Lavender isn't the only herb that grows in our region. According to biologists, our mountains are rich with some of the most ecologically diverse forests in the country, making this a ripe place to harvest medicinal herbs like ginseng and golden seal. Economists say that herbal supplements and vitamins are a $30 billion industry in the United States. Worldwide, they're even more popular with consumers. But harvesting these wild plants has mostly been considered a side job, not a main occupation for Appalachians. An organization in Southwest Virginia is trying to change that by connecting sustainable medicinal farmers with big companies. WMMT's Rachel Geringer reports.
On a sunny morning in October, Ryan Hewish, his 14-year-old son and 11-year-old daughter, stood outside the Appalachian Harvest Food Hub in Duffield, Virginia, sorting through black cohosh root.
And we have to make sure that there's no, sometimes when you dig these up, you accidentally dig maple roots with it. And so we all get pretty familiar with what the roots are supposed to look like, so we can make sure there's no adulteration.
Hewish is a professor of biology at the University of Virginia at Wise. And he's one of four growers participating in the recently launched Herb Hub, a project of Appalachian Sustainable Development, which aims to connect sustainable growers and harvesters of Appalachian herbs with national buyers.
My family and I have a farm in Duffield, Virginia. And it's more of like a homestead. I guess we grow our own vegetables and fruits, and we produce our own dairy and eggs and meat and our own medicinal plants as well. And so we have 60 acres, and a lot of that is forested with some native medicinal plants on it.
They were joined by Emily Lockney, the agroforestry program manager with Appalachian Sustainable Development. Lockney described her role with the Herb Hub as well as her perception of the need for it.
As I said, I'm the agroforestry program manager for the organization. My background is in forestry, and there's a lot of assistance and people that folks can go to if they want to get their land logged in a sustainable way. The Department of Forestry will come out to your land, and there's certifications people can access to make sure that the woods are not over-harvested. But there's a lot less information and help out there for what we call NTFPs, or non-timber forest products. And those include forest botanicals like forest herbs and also native fruits and nuts, and other plants that are sold to the floral industry. And so I view my role as making connections with markets and trying to explore new opportunities for these products.
I asked how the project has been received so far.
We're just getting started right now. We're brand new, as you can see, and we have all of our processing equipment in. This first fall, we've been so fortunate to work with Mountain Rose Herbs out in Oregon. They're a company that really values a quality product and herbs that come from populations that aren't being exploited, that they're being managed well. That's very important to them. And so they've been willing to help us throughout this process with their quality standards and making sure that we'll be able to meet them. In the future, we hope to work with a variety of herbal buyers, and we'd like to work with more local and regional buyers, and we hope to help build that industry as well.
Hewish explained that this year, the Herb Hub focused on production of black and blue cohosh, both native plants to the region, which have long been used to support women's reproductive health. I asked how he and his family maintain and harvest the cohosh root sustainably.
What we're harvesting this year is blue cohosh and black cohosh, and all the other medicinal plants on our property we didn't feel were a large enough population to sustainably harvest. But like the blue cohosh, the largest population of blue cohosh I've ever seen is in the forest behind our house. And so we felt like it was okay to harvest that, and the blue cohosh we're harvesting not as much as we could, just because we don't want to over-harvest the population. The first thing we did is we toured our forest and found out what medicinal plants were already there. And we found black cohosh and other medicinal plants. And with the black cohosh, we noticed that most of it is not reproducing right now. And we're thinking it's because the canopy is closed off. There's so many trees in the forest. And we also noticed that some of the large ash we have in our forest are dying from the emerald ash borer, an invasive species that's killing the ash in the area. And so we thought, well, that's going to be a natural canopy opening in the next few years. And so what we're doing is we're going to be taking some of the rhizomes that we harvest from the black cohosh. We're going to break off parts of those rhizomes that have buds on them, and we're going to plant them in the forest edge by our home so they get more light. And we're anticipating that they are going to start flowering and reproducing more because they have more resources to do that. And then we collect those seeds, and we're going to plant them in the areas that are going to be underneath the ash trees for the more open canopy. And there's a few invasive species in the forest, like Japanese stilt grass. There's not many of them, but we're assuming that once the canopy opens, as what happens usually when you take down trees, that invasives come in. And so our plan going ahead is to make sure that there's no invasives to compete with the black cohosh. We're kind of baby the black cohosh, keep it as natural as we can. 5-10 years down the road, we'll have another harvest.
This year, Hewish and his family have sold just under 20 pounds of sustainably harvested black and blue cohosh through the Herb Hub, and they have high hopes for the project's future.
So my hopes for the Herb Hub are that more people will understand its value, and more people will appreciate the idea of non-timber forest products and the value they have. Because I've seen little flyers in gas stations that say, "I'll buy your herbs, your black cohosh, your ginseng," and they're like the middleman who's selling to another middleman who's selling to the final purchaser, and so you don't get a lot of money for it, and so the incentives aren't that high for sustainably harvesting. So Appalachian Sustainable Development, the Herb Hub, are doing is that they're making the incentive higher so that we want to sustainably harvest these plants, and it's going to be profitable for people in the area who might not have the funding, the money that they need. And so my hopes, I guess, down the road is that more people will participate in this and that people will see the value of it and appreciate the local flora of the region.
Emily Lockneat hopes sustainable forest farming can connect Appalachian growers with a national herbal industry.
The herbal industry is very large. We're not starting anything new here, and we're not. I don't view us as the end-all answer to the question of how to maintain a sustainable herbal economy in this area. But I feel like we're offering a good opportunity for people to be able to access a higher price point than they would get typically. Ryan talked a little bit about the way herbs are bought and sold right now, and people have been participating in that for a long time, and many people have been sustainably harvesting their herbs. They might have their own ginseng or golden seal patches that they've gone to throughout their entire lives and have figured out how to harvest an amount where they're not wiping it all out. And so we'd like to allow those people to be rewarded for their stewardship and to access organic certification and a new certification called Forest Grown Verification, to be able to get into markets where they're rewarded for that stewardship and they get a higher price for that.
But for now, Hewish and Lockneat washed the root twice before putting it into the dryer to prepare to ship out to the Herb Hub's primary buyer, Mountain Rose Herbs in Oregon State. For WMMT, I'm Rachel Geringer. While these innovations are taking root in Appalachia, they haven't yet been able to stem the tide of West Virginians leaving the state. In the last year, more than 15,000 people left West Virginia. On today's show, we're talking about ways to tap into new industries and avenues for employment to give people a reason to stay in Appalachia. This is something the president of Concord University in Mercer County, Dr. Kendra Baugus, thinks about a lot.
If there were things here that they could do, and positions that they could take, and opportunities, they'd stay. People don't want to leave. They don't want to leave their homes and their families. And I think in a place like West Virginia, probably even less in many than many places where people normally do leave. So I think there's just stronger commitment to family and those values here than in many places. And we don't want to lose that.
Baugus and other higher education leaders in West Virginia have joined together to launch an initiative that focuses on economic development solutions for Southern West Virginia.
Economic development is, of course, very difficult, and it's difficult in a region where the main industry has been either removed or harmed in the way that coal has been. So many, many jobs have left, and as they've left, population has gone down, and as that's been reduced, it's caused, you know, a lot of the social problems that we see left behind. We've got to reach out and find ways to solve that going forward. So this is one effort and one way that we can begin to address some of those challenges.
Some counties in southern West Virginia are dealing with an economic climate comparable to that of the Great Depression. These are big challenges, and the vision of the initiative is that some of the solutions can be found locally, in the experts and resources on college campuses. The project aims to collaborate with entrepreneurs and municipalities. One of the initial efforts of the project is good old-fashioned networking.
What if every time we had a graduation, we sent the names of the students who are graduating and their majors, and we sent them to all the local businesses among chambers in our areas? Then there's a real opportunity that more students would get jobs in the area and would stay here.
The first step is for the project to evaluate the resources of partnering schools. Concord University Vice President of Human Resources, Policy and Planning Dan Fitzpatrick says the work comes from a belief in the value of our own institutions and people.
We have hope, and we believe things can be better. If we didn't believe that, we wouldn't be here. So we are we're hoping to help instill that hope that yes, you can. You can stay here in southern West Virginia. We can work together. We can make it better. We can improve the economics. We can improve the health care. We can improve the educational environment. We can, and we will. And it takes hope. It takes hope. and a lot of hard work.
The initiative focuses on a 21-county region. You can find a complete list of the collaborating schools and counties on our website at wvpublic.org. With so many people leaving Appalachia in search of work, employers are feeling the strain. It's sometimes difficult to find skilled, educated workers. Roxy Todd has the story of one organization that's trying to tackle this problem in a new way.
Inside a renovated building in downtown Huntington, about 20 people are at their laptops in a sunlit office without any cubicles. On long tables, senior web developers sit shoulder to shoulder with new employees. Balloons linger around one seat, leftover remnants of an employee's birthday last week. It's in this office where we find Jacob Howell, with red hair, a button-up shirt, and a neatly trimmed beard.
Back in December, I was graduating in May, and I really didn't know where I was going to end up. I didn't know if I'd be looking at a state. I didn't know if there'd be something around here to do.
Jacob Howell is 22. He grew up in Hurricane and graduated from Marshall University last year with a degree in computer information and game design. He says he wanted to stay in West Virginia, but he didn't know if he would find a job.
It seems in the tech field, it seems like there's not a lot of options here.
But then Howell heard about a fellowship program specifically designed to attract and retain young workers. It was launched by Generation West Virginia, a nonprofit that seeks to build a talent pipeline for West Virginia companies. The program is called Impact West Virginia. The companies that host the fellows agree to pay their salaries for a year as sort of a trial run at a professional job for qualified workers. Howell was selected to work here at Core 10, a technology company that develops software for clients in the financial services industry. The company is based out of Nashville, but it recently set up this new office in Huntington. Last year, there was an increase in homicides in Huntington, and Cabell County had the highest number of drug overdose deaths in West Virginia. Despite these statistics, Howell says he's committed to staying here.
If you just run from those problems, if you just turn to easier places or turn to places that you think don't have problems when most places do have similar issues, it's just going to become a cycle and more people are going to leave and those problems will just get worse.
Howell is one of seven fellows selected by Generation West Virginia, which launched Impact West Virginia in September 2017. Natalie Roper is the nonprofit's executive director.
Young people especially are motivated by job opportunities where they feel like they can have an impact. They want to live in communities they feel a part of and can be a part of determining that community's future.
But the challenge, she says, is connecting those young people who want to make change in West Virginia with jobs that pay well and help them grow their careers.
West Virginia loses too many young people to opportunities elsewhere. We are threatening our tax base, our community capacity is threatened, and our ability to attract new employers who depend on workforce is threatened. So, in other words, we see attracting and retaining young talent as the most important economic development strategy for West Virginia.
Countless other groups have tried to keep young workers here by offering them training opportunities or volunteer gigs, like AmeriCorps. But most of these projects have been funded through the federal government or philanthropic foundations. Roper wanted to try something different by partnering with private companies.
We were hearing from employers that they were having a hard time finding qualified people to fill open positions, and we were hearing from young people that they were having a hard time finding jobs that would allow them to stay after graduation.
One of Impact West Virginia's partners is Downstream Strategies, an environmental consulting company based in Morgantown. The work they do, mostly scientific research, requires advanced training, and finding the right workers has been a challenge. Mark Glass is one of the company's owners.
Yeah, I think we haven't had a hard time necessarily recruiting people from outside the state, but I do think we've had some challenges with retention, with getting people to stay here.
Glass says the fellowship has already benefited Downstream because it helped them find Sarah Cottingham.
On any given day, I can be working on something different, and I really enjoy that.
Cottingham has a Master's of Science degree in community planning, and she arrived on the job with experience helping communities boost their economies through tourism. She applied for this fellowship because she wanted to work at Downstream. She's not a West Virginia native, but she's lived here for 4 years and says she loves it.
It helps that all of the things that I like are available here. So mountains, outdoor sports, old-time music, a lot of art.
She takes me on a short tour of the office. There are three dogs sitting beside their owners.
That's the don't
want that to happen during a conference call, Sam.
And at her desk, a blue yoga ball serves as her chair. A fish tank hums beside the office kitchen. As part of her job, Cottingham's helped four towns in the Mountain State study the potential for attracting tourists. And as part of the fellowship, she and the other six fellows volunteer with a West Virginia nonprofit every Friday to help them network with other organizations and give back to the state. So far, she's helped two groups, Philanthropy West Virginia and the Tamarack Foundation, doing economic research and writing reports.
That's something special that, you know, you don't often get a job where you get a dedicated day a week to do community service.
Cottingham is hoping to be hired by Downstream Strategies or another West Virginia company when the fellowship ends. She says she wants to stay here and is even considering buying a house.
One of the things I really love about West Virginia is that it's possible to, as a young person, move here and make a difference. Move here and find a community. Move here and buy a house. Those are all things that in Austin, Texas, where I come from, I could never afford to buy a house. So those are things that make West Virginia a place that I view as a place that I could stay long term and put down roots.
Generation West Virginia plans to expand its Impact Fellowship program next year to include a larger group of young professionals and more host companies. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd.
Generation West Virginia just announced that they have 11 companies offering fellowship positions for this year's Impact Fellowship. We've posted more information on our website at wvpublic.org. Jobs in the tech industry may not be what Appalachia has been known for, but it could be a big part of our future. And in fact, coal mining requires quite a bit of technical knowledge. The days of the pick and axe are long gone. So much of the work miners do these days is done with computers and large machines. A project in eastern Kentucky called Tech Hire received several million dollars from the federal government to teach software development to people in the coal fields. The program stirred up some controversy last year after there were questions about just how many new jobs the program was able to create. Program organizers say they learned some lessons about how the program can be structured to make sure the trainees end up with gainful employment. And last August, Benny Becker reported on how the project was doing 1 year in.
This time last year, Melissa Anderson was unemployed and trying to figure out a way to keep her Pike County, Kentucky home from getting repossessed.
I have lived in that home for 20 years, and I built it. You know, for me to lose that home would have been devastating.
Anderson was one of over 800 people who applied for Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky, a program that pays participants to learn computer code and create phone apps. The program began with 54 participants, and 21 ended up in full-time, unsubsidized tech jobs. Anderson is one of 15 now employed by Interapt, the Louisville-based tech company that ran the program. She says she's now caught up on her mortgage payments.
I'm working in their marketing team and analytics, doing reports of how many people are actually going into their app, things of that nature. So I'm a numbers girl.
There's been controversy about whether the program created enough jobs, but plans are in the works for a second round of the federally funded program to start in the spring. Jeff Whitehead is director of the Eastern Kentucky Concentrated Employment Program, and he administered the nearly $3 million grant that funded the training. He says the second Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky will be run with multiple tech companies as partners.
It wasn't the results that we had hoped for, but if we hadn't had that humongous expectation, we'd be pretty happy. What we learned is that we need to create a broader spectrum of employers.
Ankur Gopal, CEO of Interapt, says his company will continue the work of training tech employees in rural communities, whether or not they take part in the second round of Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky.
We're looking at sites in Kentucky. We've been approached by the state of Wyoming, and we're in the process of announcing applications opening for those sites.
Kelly Cheney is a dean at Big Sandy Community and Technical College, which hosted Tech Hire Eastern Kentucky at its campus in Paintsville. Cheney says the space will continue to be used for tech job training.
We are partnering with healthcare, with advanced manufacturing, and some other sectors as well, but it's very much similar, having apprenticeships to do the work and be ready for a job.
Ankur Gopal says Eastern Kentuckians have shown that they're up to the task and should serve as a model for other parts of rural America.
We've proved there's capabilities, there's interest, there's a skill set that is untapped, and that's what we found.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Since that story originally aired last August, the Big Sandy Community and Technical College has continued to offer tech training in Paintsville, partnering with local employers to make sure that the training matches local job opportunities. Other campuses in eastern Kentucky are making plans to follow suit and launch their own digital training hubs. Coal has gotten a dirty reputation. There's a strong push to eliminate coal mining and the jobs that come with it in order to lower carbon dioxide emissions. But coal can be used for more than energy. In this next story, we'll learn about a company using Appalachian coal to help build rockets headed for outer space. Glynis Board reports.
NASA is preparing the replacement of the Hubble Space Telescope. The James Webb Space Telescope will launch in 2019 with a goal of observing some of the most distant events and objects in the universe. The molds required to craft such precise equipment are made of Appalachian coal. Also, next-generation rockets are being blasted into space with super strong heat-resistant thermal protection systems, also made of Appalachian coal. The guy behind these innovations believes burning coal happens to be the least economically viable thing you can do with it.
How many labor hours do we get per ton? When you extract coal and you burn it, that number is virtually zero. I don't know, there's a few people in the coal mine generating millions of tons of coal, right? If I take that and I make it into a foam, I'm probably using 10 to 100 times more labor. And then if I take that and make exotic things like molds for rockets or airplanes, now I'm adding so much value to the coal, but I'm also adding a lot of jobs.
Brian Joseph is the founder and president of Touchstone Research Laboratory. He's a proud resident and product of the Upper Ohio Valley. His lab is this innovation incubator in Wheeling that's produced a patent a month on average for the last 10 years. And now it's also spinning off companies that apply some of those inventions and innovations.
We are looked upon in the aerospace marketplace as real technological leaders. And we are working with all the major aerospace companies in the world in Tridelphia, West Virginia.
The folks at Touchstone Lab test materials that go into airplanes and rockets. They invented this fireproof, super tough foam that doesn't expand or contract with temperature variations. The group is also working to invent new exhaust systems for Navy ships, new ways to make carbon fiber airplane parts, and new forms of carbon fiber. Joseph showed us one space in the Touchstone complex where parts are being manufactured.
The foam that we make from coal has been covered with basically a plastic covering, and we're machining that off. It's going to be really thin, probably a little bit thicker than a balloon on the surface, to make a nice, in the end, shiny, glossy surface that we make parts from. So this will end up making a part to go in some kind of airplane.
This branch of the factory is one of several buildings Touchstone occupies. Other buildings are testing and creating new materials like aluminum. When asked how he cultivates innovation, Joseph reflects on a recent visit to Thomas Edison's laboratory. He says he couldn't help but notice some similarities.
His culture and his organization was almost identical to this. So how did he put out 400 patents in 6 years? So he invents everything from iron ore separation technologies to the light bulb, the world's first electrical distribution, to the world's first electric train, to, and on and on and on. How do you do that with 23 people? You find people that can make virtually anything, and you mix some people that bring new technologies into that environment. And you make a very flat structure so that everybody works really, really well together. And it's amazing how fast things move. So Edison didn't focus on, you know, oh, did you go to this school or that school? He focused on, what can you do for me?
Joseph hasn't had to search far at all to find innovators to join his crew. He says the region is teeming with people shaped by the Industrial Revolution.
In this crucible here, all these people became people who know materials. So you have generations of people who know how to work with material. They just naturally know. On every block, someone's got a machine shop in their basement, and every other or every third house has a welder in their garage, and people naturally have this ability to make things. And that is the basis, I think, on what much of what makes Touchstone really successful.
Joseph has a few tips to share about fostering innovation. He says business owners have to be willing to change and adapt, and they need to look for ways to engage with and help their communities.
Because a lot of small businesses people aren't doing this and that and the other thing for me. And the question is, what kind of community partner are you, right? What are you doing for the area? And if you, in West Virginia, if you play well in the community and you really help the community, it's amazing what they'll do for you.
Also, he says we need to cultivate optimism, that with hope, anything is possible.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board.
Appalachia is no stranger to innovation. People in this region are resourceful, often having to find new ways to survive with what we have. And today, like we heard in the show, sometimes what we have is pollution, like acid mine drainage, that can be used for technologies we use daily, like smartphones. Sometimes folks have land that's made mostly of rocks, with little soil and plant nutrients. So innovators find a plant, lavender, with such resilience that it still grows. And hey, there are still lots of forests that grow sought-after medicinal herbs. And yes, sometimes coal can still be profitable, even with strict limits on carbon emissions, because of folks who found a way to send a piece of Appalachia into space. While these aren't supporting an entire economy or community just yet, I'd like to think this is just the beginning. We've posted videos for most of the stories in the show today. Check it out at wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Most of the stories in today's show were part of a series called Appalachian Innovators, which was made possible with support from the Benedum Foundation and the Appalachian Regional Commission. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Ibi Caputo edited our episode this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.